Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the November 22, 2021, Monday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop. Today we will be reading the following main articles. I Don't Know How We Can Keep Going by Jessica Seaman. Some Killed at Wisconsin Parade, written by Scott Bauer and Mike Householder of the Associated Press. Cases in U.S. Tick Upward Heading into Thanksgiving, written by Mitch Smith of the New York Times. Cap on Hikes for Privately Insured is Sparking Battle, written by Ricardo Alonso Zaldivar of the Associated Press, and following up with miscellaneous articles. I don't know how we can keep going. Staffing shortages give teachers less time for lesson planning and helping students, by Jessica Seaman. Alyssa Hawkins has never taught in a world without a pandemic, and her students, a class of first graders at Force Elementary in Denver, have no memories of a world without one. The students were online for most of their kindergarten year, so they missed out on the socialization school normally provides. They struggle to regulate their emotions. Some are still behind their peers in literacy and other skills. But to keep kids caught up, the school district wants teachers to accelerate learning and keep teaching grade-level curriculums, and that takes help from school interventionists, social workers, therapists, and psychologists. Enter the problem faced by schools around the nation, a shortage of staff that's pulling educators in multiple directions just when a sharp focus on students is needed most. Hawkins said the support she could usually call on is needed for other roles, such as substitute teachers and lunch monitors. The biggest thing right now is that the mental health needs and academic needs are so high, it's an unsustainable system on teachers due to the staff shortages, she said. I don't know how we can keep going at this point. Colorado schools reopened this fall in a search of normalcy, only to find that the effects of the pandemic remain. They are facing widespread staffing shortages, ranging from substitute teachers to bus drivers, so severe that in a single week, DPS moved three schools briefly to online and three other metro area districts temporarily canceled classes. In interviews with the Denver Post, four educators and staff members at the state's largest school district discussed the emotional and physical toll of teaching during what remains the worst public health crisis in a century. Most described a fragile system that is barely keeping schools open, much less meeting the needs of students. Many staff members are having to perform multiple roles, leaving less time for planning lessons and one-on-one interaction with students, they said. They spoke of situations where a person was asked to cover a class because the regular teacher was away subbing for a different one, and janitors are shuffled between schools, meaning not every classroom gets mopped and swept each night, and teachers arrive the next morning to find granola crumbs and ants, according to the employees who spoke to the Post. All the while, DPS employees are facing the persisting threat of the coronavirus. Teachers expressed concern about the rise in COVID-19 cases in their classrooms as K-12 schools are hotspots for outbreaks during what is quickly becoming the state's worst wave of the pandemic. Their departments have emergency substitute plans in case teachers are diagnosed with COVID-19. The only problem? The district doesn't have enough subs. We are trying to force a reality of education that does not fit the needs or experiences of our students of the last 2 years, said Tim Hernandez, a teacher at Denver's North High School. An exodus of teachers. DPS is facing shortages in multiple departments, but it is the substitute teacher shortage that is really straining staff in school buildings. In response to the stress this has placed on employees, the district closed schools Friday so they could take time for their health and self-care. The state's COVID-19 surge is leading to a high rate of teacher absences, and the district only has about a third of substitutes normally available to fill in, said DPS spokesman Will Jones. The cumulative effects of the pandemic are at the core of what we are dealing with when it comes to ensuring that we have enough staff in our schools, he said in an email. It's not just in school districts like DPS. We are seeing this in many other lines of work. The number of teacher absences so far this year, 18,212, is just under the 18,785 absences recorded during the same period in the 2019-20 school year, according to data provided by DPS. The district did not use its substitute system last year. The problem is that fewer of these absences are being filled by substitute teachers. Subs only filled 8,590, or 47% of the absences recorded so far this year. That's down from the 12,382 absences filled 2 years ago, according to the data. District officials are not aware of any situations where the staffing shortages are affecting efforts to bridge learning gaps and mental health needs among students, Jones said. However, Jones said he is not surprised if school leaders are asking for additional help. Overall, DPS has 1,360 open positions it is trying to fill. Of those, 700 are for substitutes, 400 for paraprofessionals, and 100 classroom teachers, he said. The teachers who spoke to the Post fear the situation in DPS schools will become worse once the semester ends. There is probably going to be an exodus of teachers, said Gerardo Munoz, a social studies teacher at the Denver Center for International Studies and 2021 Colorado Teacher of the Year. Teachers have already left because they feared being exposed to the virus. Others are leaving because they no longer believe it's possible to support students the way they wanted to, he said. There just aren't enough people. Everyone is being asked to fill in when someone is out of work. Administrators, teachers, psychologists, and even parents whose school leaders are urging to sign up to substitute. There just aren't enough people in buildings to take care of everything that needs to be taken care of, Munoz said. He has gotten pulled into cover around 4 classes this year, including for his school's Smart Lab class, which has a 3D printer and is a maker space for students. I'm not an expert in that content, Munoz said. I'm a social studies teacher. Raj Wijerwardhan, a psychologist at Force Elementary, has at times filled in for lunch duty, which takes away the time he has to plan for his time working with children he sees needing more help with their social and emotional learning. He's particularly noticed younger children needing to relearn the rules and expectations of the classroom. Many are also struggling with the effects of the pandemic, whether it be the loss of a loved one, abuse, or a parent who lost their job. Having to deal with that and now having to come to school, it's just a whole lot to deal with, Wijerwardhan said. Hernandez, the North High School teacher, said teachers are carrying the weight of making sure their students meet the academic expectations of the district while also helping them navigate the realities of the pandemic. The education system is not working, and I think we need to have a conversation on when we are going to accept that, he said. Wijerwardhan, along with the teachers, said they are thankful for the district giving them an extra day off this past week. It's important people have the time to take care of themselves, he said. You can't take time for yourself if you literally don't have time. Hawkins, the first grade teacher, planned to use the day off to catch up on work and to get her COVID-19 booster shot. Then she'll be back to tackle the rest of the semester. The students who are struggling the most are being affected, Hawkins said, adding, I do worry for those students. Long term, what does that look like? Some killed at Wisconsin parade by Scott Bauer and Mike Householder of the Associated Press. An SUV sped through barricades and into a parade of Christmas marchers in suburban Milwaukee on Sunday, killing multiple people as it hit more than 20 adults and children in a horrifying scene captured by the city's live stream and the cell phones of onlookers. Waukesha Police Chief Dan Thompson said some people had been killed but would not give an exact number. A person was in custody, as was the SUV, he said, but he did not give any indication of motive. One video shows a woman screaming, "Oh my God," repeatedly after a group of girls wearing Santa hats and dancing with white pom-poms is struck. Another shows the SUV plowing into members of a marching band, their music replaced with terrified screams. Fire Chief Stephen Howard said 11 adults and 12 children were injured and transported to hospitals by his department. It was unknown how many people were taken to hospitals by others. Children's Hospital of Wisconsin said it received 15 patients from the parade and no reported fatalities as of 8 p.m. A Catholic priest, multiple parishioners, and Waukesha Catholic school children were among those injured, the Archdiocese of Milwaukee spokeswoman Sandra Peterson said. Police had custody of the vehicle, Thompson said. The investigation was ongoing with assistance from the Wisconsin Department of Justice. What took place in Waukesha today is sickening, and I have every confidence that those responsible will be brought to justice, tweeted the state's top law enforcement officer, Attorney General Josh Call. As the SUV broke through barricades at the annual parade, a Waukesha police officer fired his gun in an attempt to stop the vehicle, Thompson said. No bystanders were injured, and Thompson said he did not know if the driver was struck by the officer's bullets. One video shows the moment the SUV broke through the barricades and the sound of what appears to be several gunshots. Another video shows a young child dancing in the street as the SUV speeds by just a few feet from her before it hurtles into parade participants a few hundred feet ahead. The video of the pom-pom dancers ends with a group of people tending to one of the girls who is on the ground. Corey Montijo, a Waukesha School District board member, told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that his daughter's dance team was hit by the SUV. They were pom-poms and shoes and spilled hot chocolate everywhere. I had to go from one crumpled body to the other to find my daughter, he said. My wife and two daughters were almost hit. Please pray for everybody. Please pray. One entry in the parade, the Milwaukee Dancing Grannies, posted on its Facebook page that members of the group and volunteers were impacted and we are waiting for word on their conditions. The group's profile describes them as a group of grannies that meet once a week to practice routines for summer and winter parades. Chris Germain, co-owner of the Aspire Dance Center studio, had about 70 girls in the parade, ranging from as young as two being pulled in wagons at 8 to age 18. Germain, whose own 3-year-old daughter was in the parade, said he was driving at the head of their entry when he saw a maroon SUV that just blazed right past us. A police officer came by on foot chasing after, he said. Germain said he jumped out of his own SUV and gathered the girls who were with him. There were small children laying all over the road. There were police officers and EMTs doing CPR on multiple members of the parade, he said. Angelito Tenorio, a West Alice alderman who is running for Wisconsin State Treasurer, said he was watching the parade with his family when they saw the SUV come speeding into the area. Then he heard a loud bang, Tenorio said, and after that, we just heard deafening cries and screams from the crowd, from the people at the parade, and people started rushing, running away with tears in their eyes, crying. The Waukesha School District canceled classes Monday and said in a notice on its website that extra counselors would be on hand for students and staff. The parade's list of entries included cheer, dance, and band entries associated with district schools. Governor Tony Evers said he and his wife Kathy were praying for Waukesha tonight and all the kids, families, and community members affected by this senseless act. This year's parade was the 59th of the event that's held each year the Sunday before Thanksgiving. Cases in U.S. tick upward heading into Thanksgiving by Mitch Smith of the New York Times. A month ago, new coronavirus cases in the United States were ticking steadily downward, and the worst of a miserable summer surge fueled by the Delta variant appeared to be over. But as Americans travel this week to meet far-flung relatives for Thanksgiving dinner, new virus cases are rising once more, especially in the upper Midwest and Northeast. Federal medical teams have been dispatched to Minnesota to help at overwhelmed hospitals. Michigan is enduring its worst case surge yet, with daily caseloads doubling since the start of November. Even New England, where vaccination rates are high, is struggling. Vermont, Maine, and New Hampshire have tried to contain major outbreaks. Nationally, case levels remain well below those seen early September when summer infections peaked and are below those seen last Thanksgiving. But conditions are worsening rapidly, and this will not be the post-pandemic Thanksgiving that Americans had hoped for. More than 90,000 cases are being reported each day, comparable to early August, and more than 30 states are seeing sustained upticks in infections. In the hardest-hit places, hospitalizations are climbing. This thing is no longer just throwing curveballs at us, it's throwing 210-mile-an-hour curveballs at us, said Michael Osterholm, a public health researcher at the University of Minnesota. He said that the virus had repeatedly defied predictions and continues to do so. The new rise in cases comes at a complicated moment. Last Thanksgiving, before vaccines were available, federal and local officials had firmly urged Americans to forego holiday gatherings. But in sharp contrast, public health officials, including Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's leading infectious disease expert, have mostly suggested this year that vaccinated people could gather in relative safety. In interviews across the country, Americans said they were not sure what to think. Jess Helmorrissey, 43, a therapist who lives in St. Paul, Minnesota, said she has decided to host a dinner, although case rates in her state are among the country's worst. About 4,200 cases are emerging every day, and hospitalizations are soaring in Minnesota. They are diligent maskers and don't take any extra risks, she said of her guests. Everyone who is coming, I keep saying, is, you know, vaxxed to the max. In important ways, the country overall is in better shape than during previous upticks. Doctors have learned more about how to treat the virus, and experts are hopeful that antiviral pills will soon be approved. Americans have been vaccinated. The availability of those shots, including the recent approval of booster doses for all adults, has raised confidence for many who said they plan to proceed with holiday celebrations. But about 50,000 coronavirus patients are hospitalized nationwide, and tens of millions of Americans have declined to be vaccinated. The course of the virus in Europe, where Austria is entering a lockdown and some areas of Germany have shut down Christmas markets, has raised fears about just how high case numbers might rise in the United States. The last thing I want is what Austria is doing, said Dr. Allison Arwoody, the public health commissioner in Chicago, where cases have started to rise. I really, really don't want to go there. In Austria, about 66% of the population has been fully vaccinated against the virus. In the United States, about 59% of the population has been. Still, millions of Americans were forging ahead with holiday plans. Federal officials expected Thanksgiving air travel to approach pre-pandemic levels. And plenty of people who hit the road this year will be unvaccinated, unmasked, and largely unworried about COVID-19. Many experts said the wide availability of vaccines now authorized for everyone 5 and older, as well as at-home testing, made it possible for vaccinated people to host a relatively safe, although not fully risk-free, gathering. Arwoody said she planned to spend the holiday with extended family members, all of whom are vaccinated, except young children who are not eligible. While reports of new cases in Illinois have increased 62% in the past 2 weeks, she said she wanted vaccinated people to feel confident going about their life and to enjoy Thanksgiving. Is there the potential for some spread? Of course there is, said Arwoody, who suggested that unvaccinated adults consider staying home. Are the people who are vaccinated, even if they haven't gotten a booster, likely to end up in the hospital or die? They're really not. Osterholm said he worried about breakthrough cases in vaccinated people who did not have booster shots and about the potential for future mutations of the virus. Still, he too said he would gather for the holiday with vaccinated family members who live nearby. Infection levels are also persistently high across much of the West and Southwest, including in Colorado, Arizona, and New Mexico, where hospitalizations are rising, and in Alaska and Wyoming. Before Thanksgiving 2020, the country was reporting 175,000 new infections a day and was midway through its worst case surge of the pandemic. Vaccines were still weeks away from being authorized, many schools were closed, and at-home rapid tests were rare. But even as scientists warned that COVID-19 was unlikely to completely vanish, there was widespread optimism back then that vaccines could make the virus an afterthought in daily life. Cap on hikes for privately insured is sparking battle, by Ricardo Alonso Zaldivar of the Associated Press. Workers and families with private health insurance would reap savings on prescription drugs from a little noticed provision in President Joe Biden's sweeping social agenda bill. It's meant to break the cycle of annual price increases for widely used medicines. That provision would require drug companies to pay rebates to Medicare if they increase prices above the rate of inflation. Drugs sold to private plans would count in calculating the penalty, like a tax on price increases. The issue is dividing business groups in a fierce lobbying battle. Corporate groups focused on affordable employee benefits want to keep the language as it is, so it would provide price increase protection for companies and their workers and not just Medicare enrollees. Other groups, such as the influential U.S. Chamber of Commerce, are backing the pharmaceutical industry's drive to block restraints on pricing, including inflation caps, saying they would stifle innovation. House Democrats passed the roughly $2 trillion social agenda legislation on Friday and sent it to the Senate. The bill resets national priorities on issues from climate to family life and faces more scrutiny in that evenly divided chamber. Prescription drugs are but one component, and most of the attention has focused on Medicare provisions to slash out-of-pocket costs for seniors and allow the program to negotiate prices for a limited number of medicines. But the inflation caps would have far-reaching impact for as many as 180 million Americans with private insurance. A lot of people don't realize that the bill applies to and will help privately insured people, said Sean Greminger, health policy director at the Purchaser Business Group on Health. But that isn't a sure thing. As currently structured, that would be the case. But we have been worried and continue to be worried that will change. His coalition represents nearly 40 large employers that cover more than 15 million workers, retirees, and their families. Inflation caps would be a game changer, said James Gelfand, a vice president of ERIC, a group that represents major national companies as providers of employee benefits. Earlier legislation would have based the inflation rebates on sales to Medicare plans, but the House passed bill broadens the formula to include private plans. If they raise prices in private markets faster than the economy grows, they will be required to pay that money back to the government, Gelfand said. The goal is to deter drug companies from extravagant price increases. Polls show that Americans across the political spectrum overwhelmingly favor government action to reduce drug prices. The chief cost complaints are high out-of-pocket costs for patients, high and rising list prices, and high launch prices for new medicines. The Biden package would tackle the first two issues, but Democrats were unable to agree on authorizing Medicare to negotiate prices of new drugs. Annual price increases for established prescription drugs usually outpace inflation, although there have been periods of moderation in recent years. Greminger said his group estimates that the privately insured market could save $250 billion over 10 years under the inflation caps currently in the bill. Without them, Gelfand estimates that employers could face an additional 3.7% annual increase in health care costs over the usual medical inflation because drug companies could, in effect, raise prices on privately insured patients to make up for rebates paid on behalf of Medicare enrollees. It's true that not all the business groups are in the same place, Gelfand said, of divisions in the business community. If you look at groups on either side of the issue, there are groups that protect the business interests of pharma, and then there's everybody else. The main drug industry lobbying group, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, says inflation rebates would undermine innovation that continues after medicines are approved. The generic drug industry wants their products exempted. Dan Leonard, president of the Generic Lobbying Group Association for Accessible Medicines, said he fears his members will be penalized for price increases that amount to pennies on the dollar. When generics are not exempted, they'll get caught up in the jet wash, he said. In the Senate, Finance Committee Chairman Ron Wyden, Democrat, Oregon, who has taken a lead role on prescription drugs, supports keeping the inflation caps for privately insured people. Opponents could pursue a parliamentary challenge under Senate rules, arguing that penalizing price increases by one private company on another has no bearing on federal budgetary issues. If the challenge succeeds, costs to private insurance plans would be stripped from the inflation rebates. Supporters of the caps say they do have a budgetary purpose because they would raise revenue and generate savings for Medicare. Katie Mahoney, the top health policy expert for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, said her organization has very real concerns that the drug pricing provisions would undermine incentives for industry to develop new medicines and is pressing that point in the Senate. "We continue to hammer on the damage that such policies would do," she said. "We feel that message is making headway with senators and with some members of Congress." Asked about other business groups that are supporting inflation caps, Mahoney said they don't reflect private enterprise generally. "When you look at those other organizations, first of all, they're significantly smaller and their policy focus is very narrow," she said. "They don't represent business across the board. They represent a very discrete and narrow slice of issues." School board okays paying members. Denver payments could be up to $750 per month by Melanie Asmar of Chalkbeat, Colorado. The Denver School Board this past week voted to pay board members as allowed under a new state law passed 6 months ago. Denver Public Schools will pay board members up to $150 per day for as many as 5 days per month, or $750 per month each, for attending regular or special school board meetings, committee meetings, training sessions, and other activities approved in the future. Board members are currently volunteers. They will have to request the pay, and board members can choose to forgo it. The board voted 5-2 in favor of the proposal at its Thursday meeting. Denver's policy is less than state law allows. Board members can legally get paid $150 per day up to 5 days per week, a total of about $3,000 per month each. In a tweet, Denver board member Tay Anderson called Denver's proposal a compromise. "We couldn't get folks to agree on a higher number or more than 5 days," he wrote. Board members Angela Cobian and Barbara O'Brien voted no. Both said that although the dollar amount is relatively small, they couldn't justify the expense given that the district has other pressing needs, including increasing support for student mental health. While passing this policy seems like it's a grain of sand in comparison to the billion-dollar budget we have, it is still the case that if you vote yes for this, you are knowingly increasing the structural debt the district is taking on, said Cobian, the board's outgoing treasurer. Jim Carpenter, the district's deputy superintendent of operations, said the proposal would cost about $50,000 next year and up to $90,000 in subsequent years. State law prohibits board members from voting to pay themselves during that current term, so only newly elected or re-elected members will be eligible when the policy takes effect in January. Anderson was the most emphatically supportive. He said that for the first time in more than 160 years since Denver Public Schools was founded, the board has the opportunity to acknowledge that people deserve to be paid for their labor. "This policy will make it easier for board members to balance work, child care, and other responsibilities with attending several board meetings each month," he and others said. "This is a tough job," said board member Scott Balderman. "This is very time-consuming, and we need to provide more opportunities for people to be on the school board." Three new board members, Scott Esserman, Michelle Quattlebaum, and Watil Sochi Gaitan, are set to be sworn in later this month. Sitting board president Carrie Olson will be sworn in for a second term. She previously said she would abstain from the vote on board member pay, but ended up voting yes Thursday. The school board in Tiny Sheridan, just south of Denver, appears to have been the first in Colorado to vote to allow its members to get paid under the new law. In contrast to Denver's plan, Sheridan board members will not get paid for regular meetings, but could get paid for attending a conference that requires them to be out of town and miss work. Other school boards in Colorado, including in Aurora and Commerce City's Adams 14 district, have discussed paying board members but have not voted on proposals. And from the Faces of the Front Range series, Nurse keeps shots rolling in three metro area counties. "We're sort of the last resort for some patients," by Meg Wingerder. Karen Miller's week started a little earlier than planned when an automated call came in. A clinic had lost power. At least it was around 7 a.m., but at the Englewood clinic where she'd already planned to work that day. In her 14 years with the Tri-County Health Department, she'd had 11 p.m. and 3 a.m. calls, some of them from the other side of the department's territory. Still, the clock was ticking. The vaccines would stay at the correct temperature for 2 hours, but if the power outage was going to continue, she and anyone who was available would need to start packing coolers. "It's at that time where we have to start making some decisions," she said on a Monday morning in October, shortly before the electronics in her office clicked back to life, roughly an hour and 15 minutes into the outage. Crisis averted, but there were more fires to put out. The Wi-Fi and printer were still down, and the first patient was due to arrive in 15 minutes. Miller, a nurse manager for the Tri-County Health Department's immunization program, oversees the department's five clinics that offer shots in Adams, Arapahoe, and Douglas counties, and helps the team coordinating its COVID-19 vaccination rollout and messaging. Douglas County formed its own Board of Health to get out of Tri-County's public health orders related to the virus, but the health department still runs immunization clinics there. On that day, Miller was working with nurse Hannah Kundert, who had started in May and completed most of her training, but still needed to double-check how to handle patients who were off the typical vaccine schedule. While overseeing vaccinations may seem simple to those of us who primarily remember our inoculations as a brief pain, followed by a cartoon-themed Band-Aid and maybe a lollipop if we were brave, it's anything but. Doses have to be stored at different temperatures. Some go into the muscle, some into the fat under the skin, and heaven help you if you give a dose meant for uninsured children to someone with private insurance or vice versa. It doesn't harm the patient, but you've just bought yourself a paperwork nightmare. Given all of the complications, it takes months before a new nurse is comfortable working alone, and they've had more trainees than usual. No one left the immunization program in the 2 years before the pandemic, but five have left since, two to move closer to their families and three for other public health jobs in Colorado, Miller said. They've also had to bring on 45 temporary clinic and clerical workers, first to help with contact tracing, then to distribute COVID-19 vaccines, she said. The Englewood clinic operates two vaccination stations out of what look like repurposed cubicles with screens they can pull across for privacy. It's a relatively spartan space, apart from two Van Gogh-style paintings on the mustard-colored walls, though the sticker and snack trays are evidence that the primary clientele is young. After Miller and Kundert had vaccinated a combined five children and two adults, there was a brief lull, which Miller used to answer some emailed questions about boosters and to schedule a time for the state health department to pick up Moderna COVID-19 doses being stored at Tri-County's warehouse. It's unusual to have any downtime in October when schools are notifying parents that their children's shots aren't complete, Miller said. This is typically a really busy time of year for us, and it's weird that we have a break now, she said. The break wasn't long. An older couple arrived shortly afterward for shingles shots, and Kundert called an interpretation line to convey the possible side effects in Mandarin Chinese. After vaccinating them and bidding them good day, Kundert joked that the clinic had seen the full range of patients that morning, except for an infant or someone with a shot record in another language. Less than 20 minutes later, a mother and son came in. The boys' records were spread across several sheets of paper, some in English and some in Spanish. Based on the English language records, he was in for quite a few pokes that day, but after Miller and Kundert translated and cross-referenced the papers, he got away with only two. One for measles, mumps, and rubella, and a winter flu shot. Most people end up at the health department after something has gone wrong, Miller said. They've lost their job and insurance, or life got complicated and their kids fell behind on their vaccines, creating complications for school. Sometimes it's as simple as that their pediatrician ran out of the doses that the federal government provides and sent them to a place that could vaccinate eligible kids for free. We're sort of the last resort for them, she said. Rescue mission worker fatally stabbed at men's shelter. A Denver rescue mission staff member was fatally stabbed Saturday night at the mission's shelter for men. The suspect in the stabbing was a guest at the shelter at 4600 East 48th Avenue. Denver Police Public Information Officer Nate McGee said Sunday. The suspect, identified in an affidavit Sunday night as Christopher Christian, 22, was arrested for investigation of first-degree murder, police said. Police reported the stabbing shortly after 9 p.m. Saturday and said Sunday that the victim, a man, had died. He has not been publicly identified. Witnesses said the victim walked into the entrance of the building and said he had been stabbed outside, the affidavit said. Denver Rescue Mission's Nicole Shetter said the organization had no comment Sunday. The men's shelter is owned by the City of Denver but operated by Denver Rescue Mission, a Christian nonprofit organization. The 48th Avenue Center operates 24/7 and offers showers, restrooms, overnight beds for men, and three meals a day. Shetter referred questions about the fatal stabbing to the Denver Department of Housing Stability. A spokeswoman there, Sabrina Alley, said in a statement that the agency was deeply saddened by the stabbing. Three homes damaged in Thornton fire. Two homes were destroyed and another was damaged in a Friday night fire in Thornton. The Thornton Fire Department said the cause of the fire was not yet known. One of the homes was fully engulfed when fire crews arrived at the scene and the fire spread to two neighboring homes, KUSA-TV reported. Two of the homes were destroyed in the blaze. The Thornton Fire Department said a dog was injured in the fire but was expected to recover. There were no other injuries. Now to sports. MPJ season in jeopardy. From sources, Porter battling nerve issue by Mike Singer. Nuggets forward Michael Porter Jr. is dealing with a nerve issue in his back that could jeopardize his season, league sources told the Denver Post. The Nuggets have been vague about specifics of the injury and when Porter might be expected back. They have given him a timeline of a week to show improvements before considering other treatment options. Another back surgery is a possibility, sources said. Porter botched a layup attempt in the first quarter against Houston on November 6th, exacerbating a back injury that he's had all season. He has not played since then. Nuggets coach Michael Malone said after Sunday's loss to Phoenix that Porter was in Florida away from the team. A league source said he was seeking more opinions on how to treat his injury. Since tweaking his back more than 2 weeks ago, Porter has been getting daily treatment in an effort to strengthen the area of the injury, sources said. Porter, 23, has already had two back surgeries. The first came during his lone college season at Missouri and kept him out around 4 months. The second came after the Nuggets drafted him with the number 14 pick in the 2018 draft. Porter missed his entire rookie season as a result. Porter's pronounced struggles throughout the first 9 games of the season were at least in part because of his balky back. Nuggets guard Austin Rivers said recently Porter had been playing through injury all season. He's 23 years old, Rivers said last week. He's got to take care of himself and get himself right physically, and that way mentally he can come to the court playing the way that we know he can play. He's playing hurt his whole season. It's hard to do that. Hopefully he comes back soon because he's a huge part of our team. The Nuggets signed Porter to a 5-year max contract in late September. A large portion of the contract, $145 million, is guaranteed. Through 9 games this season, Porter was averaging just 9.9 points on only 36% shooting from the field. He was connecting on only 21% of his three-pointers so far this season, too. Hurting Nuggets, no match for Red Hot Phoenix and Chris Paul by Mike Singer. Clad in sweats with a black brace around his wrist, Nikola Jokic could do nothing to aid his reeling squad. Out of the second consecutive game with a right wrist sprain, Jokic watched helplessly as the Suns, the same team that swept the Nuggets from the playoffs last season, picked their defense apart. The 126-97 final Sunday evening gave the Suns their 12th consecutive victory and dealt Denver its fourth consecutive loss. The Nuggets hadn't lost 4 in a row since the 2018-19 season. Now 9-8, the Nuggets will face Portland on Tuesday to try and snap their losing streak. When you give up 48 in the first quarter, get down by 20, by as many as 30 at one point, you expect so much energy trying to get back into the game, Nuggets coach Michael Malone said. It was great to see our guys continue to fight, compete, and not just to roll over, but you can't allow a team to come out and play the way they did in their first quarter. Though the effort was there for most of the game, the personnel wasn't. Aside from Jokic, the Nuggets were without Michael Porter Jr., Zeke Nnaji, and Jamal Murray, who jokingly lobbied in Sunday's pregame news conference to return from his ACL tear. The injury report got longer as rookie Bones Highland left Sunday's game with a right ankle sprain after just 2 minutes in action. In the meantime, Phoenix had its full arsenal. Chris Paul finished with 9 points and 10 assists, and center DeAndre Ayton had 21 points on 9 of 11 shooting. Without Jokic to protect the paint, the Suns had their way near the rim, finishing with 56 points inside. Denver's best offensive threat, Aaron Gordon, got ejected with 15 seconds left in the third quarter after pleading his case following an offensive foul. Gordon's night ended with 16 points and a team-high 10 rebounds. Jeff Green added 19 points, and JaMychal Green tallied 14 points and 8 rebounds. Going into the next game, we had a good talk in the locker room. JaMychal Green said, "Our heads held high." "Fight," Green continued. "Go out there and play with confidence and know we're going to get the win. We're a great team. We're a deep team." With 6:15 left in the third quarter, the Nuggets finally trimmed the deficit back to single digits. JaMychal Green's three-pointer capped a 12-4 that temporarily quieted Phoenix's crowd. As Suns coach Monty Williams called timeout to stem the momentum, Jokic jumped off the bench to greet Green, who'd been struggling with his outside shot. The Suns closed the quarter on a 17-4 run, filled with Devin Booker daggers and an alley-oop lob. Denver entered the fourth down 100-78 with the game effectively out of reach. Outside of maybe Portland, the Nuggets were as familiar with the Suns as perhaps any team in the NBA. In other words, Malone knew what they were in for. "You have Chris Paul in pick and rolls, who's just a master," Malone said. "You have Devin Booker in catch and shoot in isolations. You have their three-point shooting, and then a guy who I just love to watch, Michael Bridges. Guy never stops moving. He's not a good cutter. He's a great cutter. And then you throw all that on top of the fact that they have the number three defense in the NBA. That's why they've won 11 games in a row." Phoenix came as advertised, especially in the first quarter where the Suns hung 48 points in the opening 12 minutes of the game. It was a stunning display of efficiency, talent, and depth. The Suns connected on 77% of their first quarter tries, bolting out to a 20-point lead. "So, who are these Broncos?" by Ryan O'Halloran. Start to finish, it was Vic Fangio's best day since he was hired as Broncos coach in January 2020. His defense kept the Dallas Cowboys to 16 points and 164 yards below their season averages, stopped all four fourth down attempts, and allowed only two late-game touchdowns to win as a double-digit road underdog. Fangio was flying high, his team resuscitating their season with two consecutive wins after a four-game losing streak. It was November 7th. Fast forward to Monday, when the Broncos returned to practice following their four-day bye week break. The Broncos are 5-5, but started Sunday 12th in the AFC, part of a muck of mediocrity vying for the three wildcard spots. So who are these Broncos? They are slow starters, minus 21-point differential on opening drives. They are prone to allowing big plays, 22 completions of at least 25 yards. They are terrible on third down, 27th offense, 26th defense. They are streaky. Runs of 3-2 consecutive wins sandwich a four-game losing skid, and they are average with a 500 record. We realize who we are, defensive end Dermont Jones. We're a tough, gritty team. Tough and gritty, probably so, but that usually isn't enough. Here are three storylines looking back and forward. No finishing kick. The Broncos are headed for a sixth consecutive year, finishing 22nd or worse in points per game. This group is at 20.0 for a 23rd place ranking. Among the other dreary statistics are third down, only two games above 50%, and red zone touchdown rate, 29th at 50%. On November 2nd, General Manager George Patton was blunt in analyzing the offense. "We're not good in the critical down and critical areas of the field." In critical downs, the Broncos aren't good enough on first down. They need an average of 8.9 yards to go on second down, 29th in the NFL. And the aforementioned third down issues include 70 attempts when needing at least 8 yards for 17 conversions. Critical areas, the Broncos have 17 touchdowns and 34 red zone trips. In goal-to-go situations, the Broncos leave points on the field, 11 touchdowns and 18 possessions. It starts when the Broncos get close to the red zone. They are 30th in the NFL in yards per snap inside the opponent's 30. It's not like the Broncos aren't without explosive plays. They just can't capitalize on gaining chunk yardage. The offense has at least one explosive play, rush of at least 12 yards or catch of at least 16 on 40 possessions this year, but has scored touchdowns on only 17 of those drives. They do something good, but can't stack up good plays when crossing midfield. In acute attrition, on offense, left tackle Garrett Bowles, left guard Dalton Risner, right guard Graham Glasgow, right tackle Bobby Massey, tight ends Noah Fant and Albert Okwuegbunam, and receivers Jerry Jeudy and KJ Hamler have missed at least one game because of injuries or COVID-19. On defense, the list is nose tackle Mike Purcell, cornerbacks Ronald Darby and Bryce Callahan, outside linebackers Bradley Chubb, Malik Reed, and Von Miller before he was traded, and inside linebackers Josie Jewell, Alexander Johnson, and Baron Browning. The attrition forced Patton to make trades for linebackers Stephen Weatherly and Kenny Young, both are now starters, and required Fangio and his coaching staff to instruct on the fly to young players. Help has arrived and will be on the way. Jeudy has 16 catches in 3 games since his return, and the Broncos should hope the attention he commands plus a week plus of self-scouting solves Sutton's recent bout of inactivity. Chubb had ankle surgery after lasting only 19 snaps in the Week 2 win at Jacksonville, and the anticipation externally and internally is he will boost a pass rush that has 43.4% of their sacks in 2 games against the Jets and Washington. The sooner Callahan can return, the better because of his strong coverage abilities against the slot receiver. In disappointing defense, the Broncos' modus operandi was clear once Patton started making roster moves in March, built up the defense to slow down the division's quarterbacks, adopt a ball control offense that can build the lead, and once the advantage is achieved, have the closers at all levels defense vice grip opponents. Not quite. Entering Sunday, the defense ranked 7th in yards, but isn't elite in sacks, interceptions, and completions of at least 20 and 40 yards allowed. So what are the fixes? The Broncos believe Chubb will provide a boost. Fangio has ruled out switching his base package front from 3 players to 4 defensive linemen to clog up the run lanes and account for the lack of inside linebacker depth. Getting Callahan back could allow Fangio to add layers to his coverage pressure calls because he trusts his man coverage players. Fangio should keep blitzing, though. The Broncos have rushed at least 5 players on 32.8% of the opponent's dropbacks. That usually creates single matchups for Jones and defensive end Shelby Harris, who have played well in the last 4 games. Jones has 7.5 pass rush disruptions and Harris 4. Fangio's fate will be tied to how the Broncos' defense fares against the AFC West. Can the highly paid and highly hyped secondary eliminate the big plays allowed and produce more takeaways? Can the inside linebackers, currently Young and Browning, hold up against physical run teams? The answers will drive Patton's January decision about the coaches and roster. "We have a lot of football ahead of us," Jones said. "It's not panic time, but it is make it or break it time. We have to make sure we hone in and lock it down. If we don't, everyone is going to be ticked." Emergency goalie 52 called to skate by Mike Chambers. Emergency Avalanche goalie Eric Schoppeter received the text on 7:30 a.m. Sunday. "Hey, are you in town? Can you skate?" Schoppeter said of the text from Avs trainer Matt Sokolowski. "Get over here at 11 a.m. And so the 52-year-old Schoppeter, a grandfather of 2, packed his goalie gear and drove to Family Sports Center, where he said his save percentage probably dipped to 100 in the hour-long skate. "Oh, it's ridiculous. They score whenever they want," Schoppeter, 6'4" and 220 pounds, said of the Avs shooters. "Today, I think 10 or 12 in a row went in, or they missed the net. When they miss the net, I'm like, I got that one. If they just muff it in there, then I'll stop it. If they fire it like they're supposed to in the 4 corners, it's going in. That's what they need to do. That's why I'm there. I'm better than the shooter tutor, artificial target, because I move, forces them to shoot a little better." Schoppeter, who lives in Highlands Ranch, stepped in for Avalanche third-string goalie Jonas Johansson, who felt ill. Regular backup Pavel Vantsus remains on injured reserve, but rotated in with Schopiter as a partial practice participant. He and Frankie were switching off. I came down once, and I'd be like, this is Frankie, and I need to rip one. And it went in easier than I expected. And I'm like, oh, that's why it's not Francouz, as forward Tyson Joe said, not to knock him or anything, but it's funny. But again, we're thankful he comes out. This was Schopiter's second practice with the Avs this season. He said he's done it more than 200 times since 1998, a couple years after he met goalie Patrick Watt at Castle Pines Golf Club. The 2006 Hockey Hall of Fame inductee gave him some of his old equipment. Schopiter was a caddy master at Castle Pines back then. He's now a real estate agent and driver trainer for company fleets. He used to golf with Wah and former Avs equipment manager Mark Miller. When the Avs first asked Schopiter to be one of their emergency practice goalies, he hadn't played the position since age 12 in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. Patrick knew I played goal, and he gave me all my equipment. I went over to his house one summer, and he said, take what you need. And I started playing, and it was about a year later Miller asked me to come out, Schopiter said. It's awesome that he comes out, Jost said. Sometimes guys will come down, and all you hear is the puck going in off the crossbar and the net just getting ripped. But it's fun, and we really appreciate it. You don't want to shoot on an empty net, so he definitely helps. And recovering McKinnon back on skates by Mike Chambers. Avalanche center Nathan McKinnon has resumed skating in his recovery from a lower body injury in which he was expected to miss 3 weeks. McKinnon, who sustained his injury November 6th at Columbus, skated in a red non-contact sweater with defenseman Bo Byram and forward Martin Kaut before Colorado's full practice on Sunday. McKinnon appeared to skate and shoot at full speed. After practice, Avs coach Jared Bednar said McKinnon skated on his own on Saturday, and there is a slight chance he will rejoin the lineup this week. We'll just see how he progresses, Bednar said. The Avs begin a two-game homestand Monday against the Ottawa Senators, who have had their last three games postponed because of a COVID shutdown. Colorado faces the Anaheim Ducks on Wednesday, then visits Dallas on Friday before hosting Nashville on Saturday. Next week, Colorado embarks on a five-game Eastern road trip that begins December 1st at Toronto. He'll be coming on that trip for sure, Bender said of McKinnon. McKinnon, Byram, Kaut, and goalie Pavel Francouz are each expected to participate before or during Monday's optional morning skate at Ball Arena. And for second day, Vlahova beats Schifrin at Levi, Finland. Petra Vlahova got the better of Mikaela Schifrin for the second time in two Sundays, Sunday winning another Women's World Cup slalom in Finnish Lapland. The overall World Cup champion from Slovakia was 0.18 seconds ahead after the first run and ultimately beat her American rival by 0.47 of a second. Schifrin nearly skied out in her final run but did well to recover as she came off the race line, turning into the steep pitch and only just managed to clear the next gate. I am not disappointed with anything, said Schifrin, who has won the race four times. I was pushing, made a mistake, and we don't know what would have happened without the mistake, but after that I pushed even harder. Like she did in Saturday's race, Vlahova posted the fastest time in both runs. Her winning margins on Sunday was 0.16, bigger than the day before. I like Levi. It was so difficult today. Honestly, I didn't like too much of the second run, so it was like a big fight, Vlahova said. It was the Slovakian's 22nd career win, 14th in slalom, and 5th in Levi. No skier other than Vlahova or Schifrin has won the race in Finland since Tiina Mays triumphed in 2014. Lena Dürr placed 3rd as the top three were identical to Saturday's race. The German was 0.78 seconds behind for her 3rd career podium finish. Buffs hope for strong finish to build on in 2022 in finale at number 16 Utah by Brian Howell of thebuffzone.com. The recipe was unusual, but somehow the Colorado football team cooked up a win on Saturday. If nothing else, the 20-17 victory against Washington at Folsom Field allowed CU head coach Carl Durrell and his team to go into the final week with some positive vibes. It was a good win, Durrell said. Got one left, so we're going to try to do our best one more time next week against Utah. CU is going to need its best performance, or close to it, to have a shot at beating the 16th-ranked Utes on Friday in Salt Lake City. Utah clinched the Pac-12 South title with a dominating 38-7 win against then-number 3 Oregon on Saturday night and opened Sunday as 24-point favorites against CU. The Buffs were nowhere near their best against Washington, especially on offense, but managed to play an opponent that's prone to mistakes. The Huskies' Dylan Morris was the Pac-12 leader in interceptions thrown, and he extended his lead with two more against the Buffs. A pair of fumbles by the Huskies directly led to 10 CU points. The biggest thing to me is this is a great game that really is a great testimony of if you take care of the football and the other team does give up the football. It doesn't matter how many yards you get if you're able to capitalize on some of those turnovers, Durrell said. It still gives you a chance to win, and that's what we did today. That is true, although CU can't bank on getting four takeaways too often. The last time they got more than two was the 2020 season opener against UCLA. The Buffs also can't plan on winning with every little offense too often. CU finished with 183 yards of total offense against the Huskies. It was the first time since September 11, 2004 at Washington State that a CU team won a game with less than 200 yards. Still, a win is a win, and the Buffs needed a win. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop.
Students with disabilities in Douglas County won some time after a federal judge ruled last week that a new health order making mask wearing optional in school would put students at risk of irreparable harm. But with a new conservative-leaning school board set to take over at the end of the month, that reprieve could be short-lived. David Monroe with Disability Law Colorado says if the new board decides to embrace the health order, students and families would be back at square one.
What's at stake here is the right for especially students with disabilities to have a right to get the same public education every other child does, but to get that education in an atmosphere which is safe to them, does not compromise or jeopardize their health.
Families of students with disabilities and the Douglas County School District took the county's new health department to court, arguing that making masks optional was a violation of the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act. Last week, a U.S. district judge ordered the health department to stop enforcement of the order for 14 days. County health officials disagreed with the judge's decision and claimed the order strikes the right balance between public health and parental choice. Children with disabilities frequently face serious health challenges, and Monroe says many parents pulled their kids out of school during COVID surges, uncertain if mask mandates were being followed. But when kids aren't in school, Monroe says they're losing out on their right to an appropriate public education.
There are children who have had health issues that may leave them immunosuppressed or immunocompromised. They can be at a much higher risk of having a very serious health outcome if they get COVID.
Douglas County School District's president welcomed the court's temporary restraining order and said in a statement that no one should have to choose between sending their children to school and putting their health at risk. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. Bringing print to life, 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 life.
Did you know that vapes and e-cigarettes may not be as safe as you think? It is not harmless water vapor. The aerosol emitted from e-cigarettes is a mix of chemicals that may cause harm to human bodies. This includes nicotine, nanoparticles, heavy metals, and flavorings known to cause respiratory disease. It is not an FDA-approved cessation device. E-cigarettes are not approved for cessation of cigarettes at this time. Only approved nicotine products with counseling have been proven to help people quit all tobacco products for good. E-cigarettes are not regulated. At this time, there are no standard regulations for e-cigarette products. This means that the exact ingredients or how they are made are unknown. Nicotine is present in almost all products. Though some products may claim to be nicotine-free, no regulation means there is no way to show that these claims are true. Also, there are still chemicals in e-liquids that may be harmful to the human body. Nicotine is addictive. Using tobacco products has been considered a nasty habit for too long. The truth is that nicotine in tobacco products is addictive. It can change biology and, if left untreated, can last a lifetime. Nicotine can harm the developing brain. The brain is still developing until about the age of 25. Nicotine can disrupt brain development and cause impulsive behaviors and difficulty focusing. When young people use nicotine, they are susceptible to a lifetime of addiction. Flavors attract kids. Though some adults may enjoy using products flavored like cotton candy or gummy bears, many of the e-liquids are meant to taste like childhood favorites of young people. Big tobacco plays a role. Big tobacco companies who have a history of putting sales above safety own shares of many vape companies. This message was brought to you by the Tri-County Health Department. For more information, please visit tchd.org/e-cigs.
AINC programming is brought to you in part by WannaBrands, enhancing customers' lives through the responsible use of cannabis.